Good morning, Your Holiness. I'm Susan Bauer-Wu, President of Mind and Life Institute, and it is my great honor to welcome each of you here for the 33rd Mind and Life Dialogue with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and it's the 13th that we've held here in Dharamsala. And we are most privileged to meet here in this extraordinary setting to explore over the next 5 days how we can educate our children to be compassionate, caring citizens committed to the common good. If we are to truly reimagine human flourishing, it needs to begin with the youngest among us and the values and attitudes they hold toward each other and the roles as local and global citizens. I'd first like to begin with words of gratitude to those of you who have made this auspicious gathering possible. First, to Your Holiness, for your dedication to the Mind and Life Institute, for being a curious scientist, for being a leader of secular ethics, and bringing compassion and well-being throughout the world. Thank you. And our sincere thanks to the Dalai Lama Trust, our partners in co-sponsoring this event. Without their support, without all of their efforts, this would not be possible. So to the Trust, thank you so much. And a heartfelt gratitude to the Hershey Family Foundation, who have been the primary benefactors of all of our dialogues for over 30 years. So thank you. And to all of the supporters of the Mind and Life Institute and to the other supporters of this specific dialogue, the George Family Foundation and the Pierre and Pam Omidyar Fund, thank you. And finally, a very, very hearty thank you to the Mind and Life staff who have worked so hard, tirelessly, as well as the Program Planning Committee, for over a year and a half now to make this week possible. Thank you so much. So gathered here, we have over 200 guests, and they're representing diverse disciplines and nations, and along our esteemed faculty, including noting scientists and education specialists. You've journeyed far, you've worked hard in your presentations, and we're so happy you're here. So thank you. And I also want to extend a warm welcome to our virtual audience. There's thousands, maybe more, people all over the world that are watching right now. So we welcome you, and we hope that this conversation sparks something in you that will continue in your own hearts, in your work, in your communities. So indeed, Mind and Life Institute has been a convener, catalyst, and community builder. And for over 26 years, we've been creating and growing the contemplative sciences. And by bridging research with real-world applications, our ultimate goal is to alleviate suffering and promote human flourishing. And in 1987, Francisco Varela met here with His Holiness and another small group of scientists. And these conversations began then. And the conversation, these dialogues, pioneered thinking that brought this intersection of important modern-day issues along with scientific and contemplative wisdom. So this year, Your Holiness, in keeping with your commitment to secular ethics and education of youth, we will delve deeply into how we can prepare today's young generation for their roles in a rapidly changing world. So whether today's children grow up with the skills and attitudes to live in an increasingly complex, multicultural, and interdependent world will depend in large part on the education they receive at school. And we're here this week to discuss new educational models designed to equip students with the capacity for attention, empathy, compassion, love, and forgiveness. And the stakes couldn't be higher now. Growing in growing inequities, the proliferation of new technologies, and the increasingly multicultural societies are among the trends reshaping the landscape of childhood. And in the face of such sweeping changes, young people find themselves ill-equipped to navigate a new reality. So I'd like to share with you just a few examples. Middle school students in the United States now average over 8 hours in front of media every day, whether it's computers or television, video games, and the figures are even higher for minority students. And we know that excessive exposure to media violence is linked to aggressive thoughts and behaviors, and while too much time spent on social media has an adverse effect on child self-esteem. 1 in 5 American students report being bullied as a result of their physical appearance, gender, disability, religion, or sexual orientation. And here in India, it's even higher. According to media reports, 1 out of 3 children in India report being bullied. And growing racial and class disparities are fueling tensions within schools and leaving both students and educators ill-equipped to bridge divides in classrooms. And these are just a few of the trends that are influencing how young people grow and develop. So over the last decade, the focus of much of this meeting is social-emotional learning paradigms are helping to equip students with a range of life skills to help them embrace differences and manage emotions and work together. So yet, there's even more we could do to nurture positive behaviors and ethical principles among young people. And while educational systems have long prioritized the education of mind as a pathway to a productive adulthood and material success, Your Holiness, you have called time and time again for an education of the heart. So true wisdom comes when we combine the acquisition of knowledge with the cultivation of qualities like kindness and compassion. And compassion allows us to feel what others feel, to feel what another child might feel to be bullied, or maybe a homeless person who doesn't have enough to eat. Compassion moves us to take action to alleviate that suffering. And studies, and many of these studies done by Mind and Life scientists, are finding that compassion can be taught through meditation, other types of mental training, and then compassion results in altruistic behavior. So this simple fact gives me enormous hope. And the question then becomes, what else can we learn about promoting positive values, and how do we apply this knowledge to benefit the youngest among us? Within this room are pioneers in the field who are poised to share their latest findings and their insights with us. So it's truly a privilege to be here and to reimagine with all of you how we can educate not only the mind, but the heart in pursuit of a kinder, more compassionate, and peaceful world. So I'd like to end, Your Holiness, by sharing with you the latest Mind and Life book. And this is from the 2013 dialogue at Mundgod, and it's called The Monastery and the Microscope. Conversations with the Dalai Lama on mind, mindfulness, and the nature of reality just came out. It's a beautiful book. So thank you, and that's a gift for you. And it's my pleasure to introduce the moderator for this morning, and it's Dr. Kimberly Schoenert-Reichel. Thank you.
Teresa, oh, there it is.
Good morning, Your Holiness. It's such a pleasure to be here. And I'm the moderator for this session, which is on early child development and social and emotional learning. And for this morning, we have 3 speakers. Dr. Richard Davidson, who you know very well. He's a neuroscientist, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and also the director of the Center for Healthy Minds. Then we have here Dr. Michel Beauvais. He is a developmental psychologist from Laval University in Quebec, Canada. And finally, we have Dr. Daniel Goleman, author of the renowned book, Emotional Intelligence, which catalyzed the field of social and emotional learning, and also author of many books, including the most recent, A Force for Good, The Dalai Lama's Vision for the World, which he also has a chapter on educating the heart. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Richie.
Your Holiness, thank you so much for your time and your inspiration. This is the 33rd Mind and Life meeting, and I'd like to begin by setting some historical context and discuss a bit about the causes and conditions that have enabled this meeting to proceed. And I'd like to specifically highlight five previous Mind and Life meetings that I think have laid the groundwork for the discussion that we will have over the next 5 days today. So the first meeting that I'd like to highlight occurred in Dharamsala in 1995. And it was the fifth Mind and Life meeting, and the meeting was entitled Altruism, Ethics, and Compassion. And this was the first time that we brought together scholars and scientists who had a focus on understanding the role of altruism and compassion and considering it within a framework that might provide a guide for universal ethics. We had philosophers, historians of science, and scientists discussing that at a very basic research level. The second meeting I wish to highlight was Mind and Life 8, again in Dharamsala, and it was a pivotal meeting, and that was the meeting on destructive emotions that led to the book that Dan wrote on destructive emotions, which very much helped to catalyze research in the field. And Your Holiness, it's difficult to overestimate what an impact that meeting had, because at that meeting, you very pointedly turned to us and you said that we should begin to investigate the possibility of practices from the contemplative traditions that may help to cultivate virtuous qualities of the mind as antidotes to destructive emotions. And if we find that they are valuable, we should do whatever we can to disseminate them widely. And we, I think, have been so inspired by that moment, and that moment, I think, was a pivotal moment for Mind and Life in helping to catalyze a whole generation of new scientists and scholars who've been pursuing that aspiration. Mind and Life 11 was in 2003 at MIT. That was the first public Mind and Life meeting. It was a meeting at which several Nobel laureates attended, and it was a coming out of Mind and Life in mainstream science for the very first time. And that was also a very pivotal meeting, because there was a news story about that meeting in the journal Nature, which is one of the most prestigious scientific journals in the world, announcing that contemplatives and world-renowned scientists met together at MIT for the first time to engage in this kind of dialogue, and that helped to bring to the attention of the mainstream scientific world the mission of Mind and Life in a way that had not been done before. I think that public meeting was in response to your request that we have meetings which can more broadly disseminate the information that we are discussing. Mind and Life 12 was in 2004 in Dharamsala, and it was on the topic of neuroplasticity. And we had a number of extremely well-known scientists at that meeting who were among the people who discovered some of the very basic mechanisms of neuroplasticity. And that provided a framework, a conceptual framework, for understanding how training the mind can actually change the brain and produce changes that endure in virtuous qualities. And that was also, I think, a pivotal moment for the scientific community. In 2009, we had a public meeting in Washington, D.C., with the title, Educating World Citizens for the 21st Century. And that was the first meeting that Mind and Life took on the theme of education in a very public way. And I think began to set the wheels in motion for the dialogue that we'll be having this week. So those five previous meetings have provided extremely important context for our coming together today. One of the unique features of Mind and Life is not only to bring contemplatives and scientists and other academic scholars together, but it is also to bring practitioners and basic researchers together. And this meeting will be unique in bringing together in a way that is more serious and represents a firmer commitment to bringing practitioners who are actually teaching in the field. They are what we might say in the trenches. They're actually in the classrooms teaching other teachers and children, and bringing them together with the scientists who are working on these topics for what we think will be a more fruitful exchange. So I'd like to very briefly give an overview of the arc of the meeting. The first day, as we discussed, we're going to be talking about some of the hard science about child development and how that provides a foundation for understanding social and emotional learning and where the key opportunities may be in transforming the mind based upon what we know from modern science. The second day, we'll move to social and emotional learning, something that, as Kim mentioned, was catalyzed very much by Dan's book on emotional intelligence and led to a whole worldwide movement to incorporate elements of social and emotional learning in all grades from kindergarten through high school. And it is based upon the recognition that the cultivation of these skills is probably more important than the cultivation of academic skills in producing life success. The third day, we're going to begin a deeper dive into some of the constituents of social and emotional learning and unpack some of them. So one of the topics that we will discuss on day three is meta-awareness and attention as two fundamental components of how the mind can be trained in a way that will make a difference. On the fourth day, we'll discuss ethics and compassion. And again, we will see how that emerged from the basic research that highlights our innate basic goodness as human beings and how we can take that as a seed and cultivate it and grow it into an ethical framework, which would include the ethics of compassion as something central. And on the fifth day, we will talk about the evaluation of these kinds of programs and how we can begin to implement them on a wider scale. So those are the 5 days of the meeting. And there are two other important themes that I'd like to highlight before we go into the meat of the topic for today's session. One is we see an evolution in what we're doing from treatment of disorder to prevention of those disorders to what we might call cultivation of healthy qualities of mind, which may be more than simply preventing illness or treating illness, but actually cultivating well-being and other virtuous qualities. The second very important theme is... The second important theme, and this is a bit of my skeptical scientist hat, is a caution about the meaning of specific constructs that we're going to be discussing. We're going to be discussing constructs like self-regulation, self-awareness, meta-awareness. And the honest truth is that as scientists, we do not know what the best way to measure these constructs are. And so we have words like self-awareness that many of us will use. But the way each of us is using those words may be somewhat different because it's based upon the particular ways in which we're measuring those constructs. And so it is a note of caution because the meaning of a construct depends in science on how it is measured. So with that, Your Holiness, I will now begin my brief presentation. And I am the sole representative of kind of the hard sciences here. And so it is my responsibility to cover a little bit of the material on biology and the brain, which provides the framework for what we're doing. So the key themes that I will discuss are neuroplasticity, which Your Holiness has heard much about, and I'll just say a few words about that. Epigenetics, which is the science of how genes are regulated. Sensitive periods. And what this refers to is the idea... So it's the idea that the environment is, we have environmental influences throughout life, but there are particular periods in life when our brains are more sensitive. And the last theme, which I'll just mention briefly, is the theme of innate basic goodness. So this is a little diagram of human brain development. And one of the really important facts about human brain development is that it actually continues throughout life. The brain is constantly changing. It is developing in the sense that it's changing. And it never is constant. In the beginning of life, there are certain types of changes, and toward the end of life, there are certain kinds of changes. In the first 12 years of life, there is an overproduction of synapses. Synapses are they're the connections between brain cells. And we are born with too many connections. And the process of development is a process of sculpting, where there's selective elimination of synapses which may not be important.
It's like a cleaning up process.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a sculptor who has a big ball of clay, and then the process of creating a sculpture is one of eliminating pieces of the clay to reveal a form. And brain development is similar in that sense.
Kenzo.
Can you explain why there is a pruning process going on? Because his understanding was that as you get more experience, the synaptic connections become more strengthened.
There are certain synaptic connections that do become more strengthened. But we are born with a brain that is filled with opportunity, and depending upon the environment. So, for example, in certain linguistic contexts, in languages that rely on tone, tonal languages like Thai, for example, there are certain synapses that are retained in the brain, whereas in other languages that don't rely on tone, those parts of the sort of another amazing fact is that most human beings are born with perfect pitch. They actually can judge the pitch of a tone, but that's something that falls away if it's not used. And so similarly, we have lots of synapses that don't get used and they fall away with time. So I'd like now to just show a few things in this. Just show a few things in this diagram, which there's a lot going on here, Your Holiness, but these are illustrating two different kinds of pathways in early development. One pathway that can lead to problems and to vulnerability to, for example, anxiety, and another pathway that can lead to resilience. And what it illustrates is the influence of trauma, which can occur in early life, it can occur in adult life, and the trauma affects the mechanisms of gene regulation, what we call epigenetic mechanisms. And one of the fascinating things that we've learned in science is that when we are exposed to adversity, it actually diminishes the plasticity of the brain. It actually downregulates genes that are responsible for plasticity itself. And so the very mechanisms of learning are impaired. And so that's one of the most profound things that we've learned in modern neuroscience about the impact of exposure to adversity. It actually impacts the very mechanisms of plasticity. And that's simply illustrated here. And in addition, there are changes that we see in the body, in inflammation, and also changes in the capacity to regulate emotion. So with sensitive periods, there is so much research now which shows that there are particular periods early in life which turn out to be sensitive periods. One of those is right around birth. Another is at the onset of schooling, between the ages of roughly 4 and 7 years. And a third is around the time of adolescence.
The age about
12 to 13 years of age.
Regulate 진 레귤레이터에 대한 냠뇽을 뜬 거예요. 그래서 냠뇽.
레벨 구조 맞는 남도 구조 지원을
해. So with respect to this whole epigenetic question of how genes are regulated through these encounters with trauma or whatever, so this raises the fundamental question of the relationship between brain and mind. Mm-hmm. So without brain activation, there couldn't be emotion regulation as well. Would that be the case?
Yes. So emotion regulation, the way a neuroscientist would...
Yes, through some surgery of brain, and can you really remove some emotion?
You can affect an emotion, but not, I wouldn't say remove an emotion. You couldn't remove an emotion.
So it seems there seems to be a kind of an internal law within the world of emotion that seems to be
internal
law, some kind of a norms within the emotion world, as opposed to, processes within the brain.
Of course, our daily experience.
The one chair, not chairs one. It's not on.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Of course, our daily experience is the physical level. Completely calm. Just thought come, and due to that thought, some change. So, the brain activity change come first, or thought come first.
There is research that suggests that most neuroscientists would say that the brain activity and the thought co-occur.
So this sounds a bit like, someone patching up as you go.
Your Holiness, the I often say that to my neuroscience colleagues, there is what we call the hard problem in neuroscience, which you, Your Holiness, frequently come back to, which is the problem of the relation between the mind and the brain. And most neuroscientists, the vast majority, dismiss it. What I try to do with my students is to encourage them to have some humility about this question and to simply appreciate the fact. I believe that neuroscience has not made any real progress on that question in the last 100 years.
Now, I want to say a few words. Very purpose of this is a meeting with scientists. I always say two things. Number one, our knowledge. It seems now to me, over a few decades of experience, the ancient Indian knowledge about mind. So obviously, Indian tradition, the practice of shamatha, practice of vipassana, so single-pointed mind or analytical meditation. So these are transforming or method to transform our mind. So over 3,000 years, is in that tradition there. So naturally, more knowledge about mind, about emotion. Then, in physical world, some are sort of traditional sort of belief, oh, world flat, and the center Mount Meru, and the sun and the moon go like that, and almost according Bosubantha's sort of text, they almost same size and same level. Now these, I think, sometimes I jokingly say, telling, I think some of you may have heard, you know, the Bosubantha, when he wrote Abhidhammakoshakarika, naturally his age quite old, so his eyesight not very good. So he look when cloudy day, looks sun size. Oh, then he felt size of moon and sun almost
almost similar. Yeah.
And same distance. Now these things, when we learn from sort of also the scientific knowledge, then world is round. It's very true. Me personally also, from India to Europe, Europe to America, then Hawaii, then Japan, I never saw Mount Meru. And you cannot say, oh, Mount Meru is something special we can't see. That also difficult.
So in the text that proposes this kind of cosmology with this mountain in the middle, already speaks about how human beings on planet Earth experiences the shadow, falling of the shadow when the sun rotates. So if we are experiencing the shadow, and if the source of that shadow is invisible, that just doesn't make any sense.
So now I publicly mention no longer sort of, I said, believe the Mount Meru and of flat world like that. So it shows now we should learn the scientific sort of finding. And meantime, scientific finding alone not sufficient when terms in the subject of our emotion, how to tackle this. The scientist, I think, still beginning to, you see, to look that field. Whereas in this country, over 3,000 years. So now, it is useful to combine these two things. So, and me personally, since from my childhood, I have some interest about machines, how to moving, and electricity, how to produce electricity, like that. So that brings interest about science. And after 59, come to India, I had the opportunity meeting with, I think, genuine scientists, more open-minded. Wonderful. I'm saying this because 79, my first visit to Moscow, then still Soviet Union, because I have some interest about sort of discussion with scientists, so I request the concerned people, I want to meet some scientists. Then four or five scientists come. And when we start discussion about mind, sensorial consciousness, and then mental consciousness, we call sixth. As soon as I use the sixth mind, they reject. Now that's a religious matter. So, therefore, I'm telling you, see, the Western scientist more open-minded. Very good. So, So then I really learned many useful things. Cosmology, then neurobiology, then physics, particularly quantum physics. Now I invited one, my Russian, English, because of the Indian.
Physicist, yeah.
We met him last night. Met him last night.
So wonderful. So actually, I have some keen interest about quantum physics. I learned from David Bohm, late David Bohm, and then von Weizsäcker. Wonderful. Wonderful. So, so then now, this is our meeting, since our first meeting, two purpose. One, expand our knowledge. External things, internal thing. Now, the second purpose, whether you say there is, we may call century by century, further develop more civilization. I doubt. Technology, machine, these fields, yes. Decade by decade, much diversity development.
No.
But human emotion is concerned. Now, this very moment, we enjoy peace.
Comfort, love.
Oh, comfort, joyfulness. Same planet, same human being. This very moment, I think how many people killing in Syria, Yemen, and some African state. We same human being. Due to some leaders, their own interest, they don't care. Thousands, thousands of human beings' life, including children. That's today's world. We cannot ignore these things. We are part of humanity. So some human beings suffer there. We cannot ignore. We have to think. We cannot solve this problem immediately. But time passes. So this moment, now the later part of 20th century, and now beginning of 21st century, I think the century goes like that. So if we think seriously, make effort now, I think the later part of 21st century can be a little better. So these days, I really feel, in spite of many sort of material development, life become more easy, comfortable. But there is suffering. But there's a lot of suffering because of emotion. We are facing some kind of crisis of emotion. So if you can remove this emotion through surgery, then I will relax.
We can't relax.
So therefore, now it is obviously now shows sense of concern of others' well-being. As a human brother, sisters. So therefore, now, that means compassion, sense of concern of their well-being. And so therefore, now we need sense of compassion, sense of concern of others' well-being. And on the basis, sense of oneness of 7 billion human beings. And secondly, we are social animal. We are same community. In past, when we say community, just their own circle, their own area. Now today, the 21st century, because of global warming and global economy, now east, west, south, north, everyone interconnected, interdependent. So now, our sort of human community, we have to think entire, or say the 7 billion human being. So now, the method to promote human warm-heartedness or compassion. Religious teaching, over 2,000, 3,000 years, this teaching carry, but not much effect. Sometimes you see religious people, you see, the religion itself create more division and killing. Syria, Sunni and Shia. And in Egypt, because Christian and Muslim. In Burma, Muslim and Buddhist. The last few days, I think in Sri Lanka also some problems. Mm-hmm. So now, the time come. We have to create, use common sense, and as you mentioned, basic human nature is more compassionate. One occasion, some of our meeting with scientists, they say basic human nature is more compassionate. When I heard that, now there's hope. If human nature is more anger, then no hope. Since basic human nature is more compassionate, and then our experience also, more compassionate mind there, self-confidence develop. You see, that carry transparent. That reduce fear. Whenever I meet people, even beggar or sweeper, I always consider we are same. I smile. Teasing. If they are not respond, smile, then I do this.
I'm ticklish.
So then immediately, you see, we become human being. Oh, too much formality. Oh, religiously or some socialist way. Too much formality. I don't like it. So the basic human... So, according to our daily experience, if you remain suspicion, distrust, you never be a happy person. Open. Kasoda, extend your love towards them. We immediately become friend. Then you feel happy. The whole sound warm. Too much formality. Remain a little bit distance. You won't be happy person. So that is our use common sense. So now, since religion, firstly, I think 7 billion human beings, according to some article, I noticed, out of 7 billion, 1 billion non-believer. These also human beings. So our work try to promote compassion, including these non-believer. So therefore, now secular way, not talking about next life, not talking about God, but how to be day-to-day life more peace, joyful, and more smiles. Okay. So now, scientific sort of, as the scientific way, explain warm-heartedness is your own personal sort of physical health, very important. And through that way, Yeah, your face always remain more smile. Otherwise, you see, some you see beautiful lady, she looks beautiful, but angry face never looks beautiful. So smiling, expression, smile also, you see, I usually say telling, diplomatic smile, sarcastic smile, and genuine smile. So genuine smile brings home because of closeness. Diplomatic smile, more distance. Isn't it? A sarcastic smile develop anger. So in any way, now time come, we have to think about humanity, not my nation or that nation. I really feel now outdated, too much emphasis my nation, or my religion, their religion. Now environment, I think, really indicates us. You 7 billion human being should live as a one small community. Environment is never make because of differences or on the basis of different continent or different country or different religion. So now, I think global warming, I think decade by decade increasing. When I come through, over Afghanistan, we can see many dead lakes empty. Now, many parts of the world, in Africa, or I think many parts of the world reduce water. Mm-hmm. These are very serious. Then South Pole, North Pole, these ice quite rapidly now melting. So nature disaster will increase. Environmental problem really now important because of the serious. So now talking my nation or my faith, I think very small. Not worthy talk. So therefore, one of our responsibility is to educate through scientific way. Not like me, teaching, not that way, but through education on the basis of scientific finding. That's the only hope. So one purpose of our meeting right from the beginning is how to cultivate, how to educate on the basis of scientific finding. We can, children say, God, I think too young, maybe, God. They're a little growing. Where's God? Where's Buddha? Difficult. Now we have to sort of cultivate, you see, these quality inner value through scientific way, the secular way of education. So that's, I feel, one of the main purpose of our meeting. I think I must sort of say, last so many years, number of scientists, and late Varala, now no longer, but he made tremendous contribution. And the wife, Kodota,
Amy is here, yeah.
Yes.
And Gabe.
It was two.
Became the two.
Yes. Yes. So thank you. So this also, now, this reminds me, world remain, I think, another few thousand years.
So, the Abhidhamma text that His Holiness was talking about, which is the source of the Buddhist cosmology idea, also speaks about the end of the universe, end of the world, And it talks about different ways in which such destruction would occur, one of which is through heat and fire. So His Holiness was saying that maybe there is something there.
Global warming, that's the beginning. Go like that. So, at least, you see, next few thousand, I think human beings remain on this planet. Now, our generation who witnessed past century, too much violence. At the beginning of the 21st century, too much violence. Now it is our responsibility to show next generation we have to pay more attention about our inner value. We have to live side by side. Some other things are minor, I feel. So then personally, as the Kasa, the Varela, now no longer, and Bob Livingston, also no
Robert
longer.
Livingston, yeah. Bob Livingston.
Then myself, now nearly 83 years, not much time left. Perhaps next few years I can be active, then we'll go. If there is heaven, I may go heaven. If not, I will reborn on this planet and try to make as much as I can make some contribution for inner peace till the space remain. That's my daily prayer. So long space remain, so long sentient beings suffering remain. I will remain. Try to make little contribution for peace of mind. So in any way, it is our generation's responsibility. We witness some lacking. So because of past centuries, the event, too much war. Because of war, because of violence, spent a lot of money for weapon, including nuclear weapon. So people still now, today, whenever they find some problem, they are immediately thinking how to solve by force. Like Iraq crisis. I know President Bush, his motivation is very good, but method is wrong. So that we witness now. So unfortunately, beginning of this 21st century, I think still the way of thinking about the past century, thinking, use force. So spend a lot of money for weapon. This must change now. This is very much related with my nation, a political boundary and religious boundary. Like that. So, sorry, too much. So I want to say proudly, me, half Buddhist monk, half scientist.
So, Your Holiness, I'd like to just show a few more slides and carry on with some of the themes that you have inspired us to consider. One of the most important issues... One of the most important issues coming out of the science is this sensitive period notion, and one of the most sensitive periods is in the first 5 years of life. This Jim Heckman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in the year 2000, and one of his main contributions is to show that when we invest in early education, there, in economic terms, there is a 13% return on investment by the time the individual is 30 years of age. And so it makes sense in economic terms for us to invest in our children and to educate starting very early in life. So important. There's an urgent need. There's findings which show that qualities like the capacity to regulate ourselves, self-regulation, is a better predictor of outcomes when an individual is in their 30s than IQ.
30. This
is really, in your language, Your Holiness, this is the ethics of restraint. And that's a better predictor of young adult outcomes than IQ, income, and grades, all put together. And so if we can teach children these simple skills, we can make an enormous difference. So I think, Your Holiness, you've seen this little video, and there'll be discussion about this throughout the week. But these are two short video clips, very short, that are shown to very young babies. And here's one of them. So that's one, and here's the other. So we
the same picture. Yes. One occasion, you see, show two children helping each other with smile to show one six-month-old child. When the child see that, the more compassionate face and helping each other, the child smiling. Then another cartoon, two children. Negative attitude one another, and that show to that six-month, isn't it?
Six months.
Language not yet developed. So that's, I think at that time, the nature thing is very, very fresh.
Fresh.
Not yet sort of influenced from outside. Language not yet come. So when they saw, when that boy saw negative attitude, clearly shows unhappiness. Then our daily experience, basic human nature, is more compassionate. That is real hope, as I mentioned earlier. So now, education. Existing education system. I feel too much oriented about material value, external value. Not much think about inner value. So now these days, you may not heard before. These days, I'm sort of telling, expressing. Now, hygiene of physical in our education include. Now, hygiene of emotion should include.
Yes. And it's beginning to slowly happen.
So education from kindergarten level up to university level, I think that's we can do. And that's the real sort of the, cause of the
basis of hope.
Basis of hope. Then this, the scientist with big nose, you see, I think your name will carry whole this century. And perhaps I think our work can affect the next two centuries, I think. So then these next generation, they will sort of praise us.
and To amplify on the urgent need, Your Holiness, I just want to show a few, couple of more things. This is just showing in the United States the percentage of youth between 12 and 17 years who experienced an episode of major depression in the last year. And you can see on the left these trends just going up in every age group from 12 to 17. And on the right, you can see the differences between females and males. The females are in yellow, the males are in blue. And in 2015, that gender difference was greater than it's ever been since we have been measuring this. And the disparity is caused by the females showing a big increase in depression.
Cancer. Why would that be?
Well, let me show one other slide. This is suicides by year in the United States. These are in children, in adolescents. And you can see there's been more than a doubling of the rate of suicide between 2007 and 2014 in the United States.
So far, any sort of study number case of suicide in big cities and rural area?
Is there a comparison done?
In this country, some of my friend told me the suicide rate in city much higher. In countryside, farming, he didn't sort of explain why, reason. I felt in big city, you may have big salary, but you something like part of the big mission, go like that day by day. Less the human sort of feeling, human contact.
Yes.
Sense of community, yes. Much less. In countryside, farmer. So occasion, firstly, I think they much sort of closer in nature.
To the land, yeah.
And then occasionally work together. So sense of community is much stronger. So I've felt that. So now I think environment issue. People and live in big city, not much notice. Right? I think countryside, the farmer, they know the rate, right? And because of warming, these things, they know. So the villager, countryside people, more closer with nature than big city. Mm-hmm. And particularly professors in universities.
So you asked about surgery for the brain before. This man was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health in the United States for 13 years. He was responsible over those 13 years for a budget of $20 billion where he supported research. And what he said is, I don't think we move the needle in reducing suicide, reducing hospitalizations, improving recovery for tens of millions of people who have mental illness. And he said, I hold myself accountable for that. This is... And so he has come to the conclusion, Your Holiness, that the methods for mind training that are so important in the Buddhist tradition, that whole family of methods is going to be the solution, not surgery and not drugs, because they haven't impacted this despite spending $20 billion. So well-being is an urgent public health need. And we need to harness the opportunity, the power of science in our culture today that is informed by the wisdom of the traditions that Your Holiness represents. And we need to bring this out into the world. And we really have an urgent need today more than ever before. So Thank you, Your Holiness.
Don't expect
too much.
Oh. I have mouth. Bala. No soru kasota. No knowledge is how to do.
How to do things.
These people say you can do more. I just occasionally blah blah. Then rest.
Well, I always say that we've all learned to brush our teeth several times a day as a kind of personal physical hygiene. And what we're talking about is a personal mental hygiene. And we envision a day when people learn about their mind and their brain, that they will take responsibility, more responsibility for their own mind and brain. And even if they spend a few minutes each day cultivating their mind like brushing the teeth, I think the world can change.
True. That's true. That's the only way. Only way.
Thank you.
Let's have a tea break.
Thank you very much. We are now going to take a 15-minute tea break and come back.
Thank you. Great.
We're going to begin. Thank you. We are now going to hear a talk by Dr. Michel Boivin. Take it away.
Well, first of all, good morning, Your Holiness. Good morning, everyone. First thing first, I would say that I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you to Mind and Life for inviting me, giving me the occasion to talk a little about my work. I shouldn't say my work, it's more our work, because this is pretty much a collective effort of researchers interested in developmental issues in Quebec, Canada. I come from a different perspective than Richie, so I'm a developmental psychologist. The questions I'm interested in are obviously the same as Richie, but I use a different perspective. I'm interested in developmental trajectories of children. So I'm interested in a variety of developmental trajectories, individual differences in terms of, for instance, why are certain children more aggressive than others? Why are certain children more successful in school than others? Why are some children more anxious than others? So it is a variety of questions, all dealing with individual differences. We do it through platforms of research, and our platform are longitudinal research. So what we do is we identify groups of kids that we follow over time. There has been at least two of these studies that were initiated in the mid-1990s in Quebec. So if I can bring your attention to the slide, there are two studies that of kids, one of which is a representative sample of children who were born in Quebec in 1995. So it's a representative sample. So we're talking 2,000 children and their families who were assessed first at 5 months and then regularly until age 7 years. We're now doing age 19 years. So we have a wave of evaluation, different waves of evaluation over time. So children were first assessed when they were 5 months of age, and then a year later, 18 months of age, 30 months of age, and so on, until they enter school at age 6 years, and we follow them through in school, and now some of them are into universities, others just are working, but we keep on following them. So that's the first study, and we assess them on a variety of things. So, of course, social, emotional behaviors, but we're also interested in educational issues. So we measure cognitive skills, we measure how parents treat their kids. So, parenting. We assess, of course, when they are in school, we assess their school grades. We test them in different means, and we also observe them when we have the means to do it. So that's the first study. There's another study that we also started about the same year. These are twin study. So it's a 600 families of twins in the Montreal region that we've been followed the same way, more or less, the same way as the 2,000 representative sample. So because we do this, we can assess what we call developmental processes, how they develop. We can trace their trajectories on different outcomes. In this case, we can talk about behaviors, so we can draw trajectories of these kids and identify if you have specific trajectories that they tend to follow. And to make a long story short, when we do this, we can see that there are a small sample of kids. There is a small sample of kids that show more of these negative behaviors over time. About 10 to 15% of kids in the population, in the 2,000 representatives, that are more, say, aggressive. And if you target shyness, for instance, because we assess shyness, you also find a small group of kids who tend to be shy and tend to be stably shy over time. Because we do this very early on, we can assess trajectories very early. And what we see is that, and that's the first, maybe the first lesson of these longitudinal studies, is that developmental trajectories are established very early in life. So we can see as soon as we can assess shyness with reliability, as soon as we can assess aggression with reliability, there's a tendency for individual differences to appear and to stay relatively stable. These trajectories, especially the high shy or the high aggressive kids, these trajectories predict to different type of outcomes. So they predict to future development. Shyness predict obviously to anxiety and to further shyness, maybe difficulties with interacting with peers, whereas, for instance, aggression predicts engagement in criminality or sub-criminality activities. So there's a link between what we see in early childhood and later outcomes. So that's what is allowed by following kids longitudinally. The other important things that we saw in examining these trajectories is that when we look...
So his holiness was asking, this sort of, you know, a thought occurs to him.
Given your kind of longitudinal study and study of the twins, has ever a study been done, even among twins, sometimes you see differences, individual differences, where one child seems to be more prone to the pressures of the peer and the other seems to be less.
Yes.
Has there been any study done on this?
Yes. I will talk about the twins a little later, mm-hmm. but of course, okay. when you have twins, you can compare the two children of the same family, and you can sometimes assess that one is like that and the other is different in terms of temperament, but they tend to be alike. But I'll come back to this if you allow me. The important point, I think, is that when you look at the predictors of those negative trajectories, so to speak, there's a variety of factors. There's not one explanation. You have child factors, and I will explain, genetic factors are important, are part of the story to explain individual differences. For instance, for aggression, males, boys tend to be more aggressive than girls. So these are child factors, but we also have family factors and factors related to the parents. For instance, mother, or I should say parent being depressed, is one risk factor. We also have the usual suspect in terms of predictors, low income, single motherhood. Those are coming out, but it's not only one factor, it's a cumulative effect of factors. The last, and I will go into deeper into this, is that these trajectories are governed or influenced by what I call complex gene environment interplay. And I will take some time to talk a little about this. Whoops. my square is a bit thin, but the idea was to just illustrate to a metaphor what we intend by gene environment interplay. There was a famous Canadian neuropsychologist, Donald Hebb, who was asked, what is more important to human personality, nature or nurture? Genes or environment?
My personality,
and his answer was, what is more important to a square? Is the length more important or the width more important? So, obviously, he meant that the two are very important. Square are square, persons are persons, and obviously, the environment and the genes combine in one becoming a person, and as the length and the width are important for the square. But as a scientist, we need to measure these things differently so we can assess how they interact. And we do this in a variety of ways, one of which, and I'm back now to the twin study, we use twins to assess the role of genetic factors. And I'll try to explain very briefly how is it so. Twins are really a gold mine for developmental research because here you have two infant born at the same time, in the same family, who will go through the same events in the family at the same time. So they allow to look not only at between family differences, but within family differences. And parents who have more than one kid know that there's a lot of differences, could be a lot of differences among children of the same family. So that's an important assessment point. We can do this. The additional added value of twins is that if we simplify things, they come in two kinds. You have monozygotic twins and dizygotic twins. Monozygotic twins.
Livingston.
Bob Livingston.
For the
His Holiness was talking about Robert Livingston, the late biologist who spoke to him about the importance of chromosomes and how it differs from individual to individual. Mm-hmm. So among even the monozygote twins, is there such a level of similarity even at the chromosome level as well?
In principle, they are genetically copy of each other. But you may have variations as they go old. So, of course, genes will not be expressed. They could be genes that are not the same at certain point in time. But by and large, for what we do, we consider that they are genetically similar. And I think that stands genetically.
The actual sequence of the base pairs that constitute the DNA is the same for identical twins, but the extent to which a gene is regulated is different.
Different.
Mm-hmm. Whether it turns on or off, in other words. Mm-hmm.
So, for the sake of calculation of genetic factor, what we do is we compare. So you have these monozygotic twins. They're about more or less one third of the population. And so two thirds are dizygotic twins.
Same in Alolia. To be some down, some just chicks cheat that and monozygotic. Kind of the gene chip in the near chair. That to be some gene, chasm
the gene. You mean in the study? Not the general population. In the study.
In the twin.
By and large, in the population, it's one third, two thirds, more or less. In our own sample, of course, it's one third, two thirds as well. So it's a natural experiment in genetic relatedness. So because we can assess how twins are similar, fraternals as well as monozygotic twins are similar within family, and then compare them, their degree of similarity. To the extent that monozygotic twins are more similar on a characteristic than dizygotic twins, it suggests that genes explain this differential.
다가다 세마 다다 진 차 지부지장이 되니 리지다 지부지장 맨드니 리 난코 두르바이나 아니 아직 시계에 돌이야 세마니 그 버룰이야 튼조유 지섬 숙체유나 디수요게 다디 진라 때네 랄레기 요르신 되시접 두고로 왔어 다 시계 돌이야 천왕원에 단 진 차장 대장합 좀 어떤 충분 많이 맞게 들이야 시계 개발된 것도나 아니 진 개발된 So his Holiness is wondering, since the monozygote twins share such similarity, but even in their conception, you know, the location, which side one of the twins is,
yes,
is a different one. Would that also affect their differences?
Of course, development starts in utero. So there may be some experiences in utero that could explain the differences.
So what about, because when they are born, you know, one comes earlier and one comes later, that would also affect.
That's all possibility, but it can be assessed. The thing I want to point out is that we have families of monozygotic twins and families of dizygotic twins. And there's no reason for believing that the environment in utero to which they are exposed is much different than what the dizygotic are exposed to. With monkeys.
세마 진직과 인바 부근익바로 염제도 그렇게 마셔보세요. 또 세마 진직과 인예가 리다. 진직과 매니가 리니부 되기 버루가 개발돼.
So.
대체 변다 굳지도 내 양고 세마 진지고 매년에 콜이야 예조 연조 돼야 다 깨나지디 콜에요 들어와 다 주나고데 진지고 인엘에 깨나지다 예조 연조디 데레창데 두걸 고도 두려야디 리디니 버르드고요 그래서
So am I right in understanding your point is that the comparison is not made within this individual twins, but rather between these two types of twins?
Yes, in terms of their similarity.
Yeah, similarity.
So we assess similarity. Are they similar? Sure. Could be not. And then assess the same thing among dizygotic sure. twins, and then we compare.
Sure.
And then we compute. There's a lot of mathematics in that, so it's very complicated. I don't have time to, and it's not the place, I think, to go into the details. But essentially, the lessons of the twin studies around the world, including our own study, is that genes are important in explaining, accounting for individual differences with respect to social-emotional dimensions. Or behavior problems like aggression, for instance, or shyness, for instance, or anxiety, they account for about 40 to 50% of individual differences, which is important. But this is a statistic. So this percentage, 40, 50%, is also dependent on the environment. So it may change. It could be lower, it could be higher, depending on the environment to which the twins are exposed. For instance, I'll just give you a brief example. We've assessed the role of genes on cortisol at 18 months, and we compare two types of families, families who were subjected to adversity on a variety of variables, and 75% of the other family were not exposed to adversity. And what we found was that in the absence of adversity, for 75% of the families of twins, the cortisol response, the stress response, was heritable at about 40-45%. Whereas in the presence of adversity, the genes had no effect.
The stress and the cortisol chemical touch the chemical touch family nalulia jikitu da de kangen shu chim me nyen zu liya ani dan de jin ge ton ne ja je shi chu de jap to to ko stress response chi kan de chi gre se da dan de kangen shu chim bu ten yen de liya ani ja je jin ge ton ne de she ja me do ko kangen de shu
So it's not an absolute effect. It depends on the environment. And that's important.
So what sort of age we are talking about?
So the age of the twins in that experiment, in that measure, 18 months.
18 months.
They were exposed to a strange situation, and we measured the cortisol response in the context of...
But you're talking about the effect of the adversity of the family
yes.
on the child.
Yes.
Rishat, and the gang it has the Pamazu Kitu gang at the day, now Salon Chetin Pugutila, and the stress gang at Tebekalias, Rishat. Does the heat or the weather makes a difference or no? The climate.
I don't know. We would need to measure this at the level of the family to be able to compare. But the climate change is affecting everyone the same.
I was just wondering, the Scandinavian country, northern world,
long period, countries.
Sometimes completely dark, night, or summer or something, light. Any differences?
Drink more alcohol.
The best answer is I don't know. I don't know. Because these kids are in Quebec, so it applies only for... So the key point I think I want to make here is that genes are important. They account for, in the population, significant portion of individual differences, but it's not a fixed entity. It varies depending on the environment.
So
that, So that's the point about twins. The other side of this is that we've been looking for the genes. We now have the means to assess the genotype. We have new ways of assessing multiple genes at the same time for cheap ways. It's not very costly. And people have been trying to identify the genes that are responsible for these individual differences. And this has been very elusive, very difficult to find. And this is because it's likely.
Because Solanus remembers hearing about how when anger arises, there's a certain activation in a specific location of the brain. I think he's talking about amygdala. Is that what
it is? You know, the kasore, strong compassion develop.
There's similar activation in the same area.
More movement.
Is that true? Solanus remembers saying that in that case the brain seems to be pretty dumb because it seems to respond at the brain level similarly to whether it is compassion or anger.
I think it's the neuroscientists that are dumb in not really understanding.
But this is
actually a very interesting and
complex. I think quite simple. Sometimes you say out of fear, tear comes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you say too much of love, tear comes. So different causes, emotional level. But a physical reaction, same.
Well, I think it has to do with more about the detection of suffering. A person who is very sensitive to suffering may have a hyperactive amygdala, and that sensitivity to suffering may be an early inspiration for compassion, maybe even be necessary for a strong, compassionate response.
But in the case of compassion, sometimes it arises out of courage, because you are opening your heart to responding.
So there's big differences.
Yeah, and so in a situation where it arises out of courage, it may be a very different neural signature. We, are still at a very nursery school stage of studying compassion. So. But we do know that people who are highly altruistic, who donate kidneys to an unrelated individual, for example, they actually have a larger amygdala. So it may be that they can sense suffering and it motivates them to act.
We're going to move on now and have Dr. Daniel Goleman talk about social and emotional learning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
You can go this way.
And do a bit of a chewing shampa.
Oh, you can come.
Your Holiness, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you. And we're grateful for the time and your attention. I'd like to build a bridge between the hard science, the brain science, and the genetics, and what you're going to hear about in coming days, which we call social-emotional learning. You call it education of the heart. And there are several points I'd like to make, but because of time, I'll be quite brief. One is history of how this emerged. And the second is, what do these programs look like in general? And how do they build on the hard science? So you've heard that a certain proportion of children are aggressive or violent. That's genetic. You've heard from Richie that there are terrible problems with teens, depression, suicide. This was something that the U.S. government tried to do something about in the early 1980s. They called it Wars on Violence. Their prevention programs, wars on suicide, wars on drug use, and they were all prevention programs. Some worked very well, some worked terribly. There was one program to prevent drug use, where police would go around to schools and show children drugs and how bad they were. It actually increased the use of drugs, they found. So there was a study done to see, well, what actually does work? What prevents, what lowers suicide rate? What lowers violence rate? And they found that the active ingredients were the same, no matter what you were trying to prevent. And it was basically building children's capacity for flourishing, for well-being, self-awareness, self-management, empathy, and social skill. And that finding was very important to a group of us about the time I was writing the book Emotional Intelligence. Some of those people had started programs in schools, particularly one man at Yale University, Roger Weisberg. He worked in the New Haven schools, where they had a lot of very poor children who had been traumatized. And that program and about three or four others became the basis for an organization we founded called Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. And that's the group that's been promoting most of the programs you'll hear about. This is basically, if you look in the orange, you see self-awareness and self-management. These are the skills that they try to teach children. In the green, social awareness, that includes empathy, relationship skills, cooperation, collaboration. And then the yellow is very important because it builds on both. Responsible decision making. This is where the ethical dimension comes in. So the programs are trying to give children the skill to be better people and make the right decisions in life. And you see the circles around it. It involves the classroom. You'll hear a lot. You'll see some demonstrations of what goes on. The whole school, the culture of the school needs to be involved. And then parents in the community. So the best programs have all those dimensions. They also teach these skills in a way that's appropriate to the age. So for a five-year-old, you teach decision-making in one way. You might say, this is something I saw in New Haven. These are six-year-olds and seven-year-olds. The teacher says, what would you do if you thought someone had stolen your pencil? What would make it better and what would make it worse? Well, if I hit the kid, it'd make it worse. If I asked him, did you do it, make it better? Very simple. But then they teach the same thing at each age level so that depending on the ability of the child to understand, they learn it again and again and again. And this has to do with Richie's point, which is that all of these programs build on the idea that the external behavior you see in a child at different ages reflects the growth of that child's brain. And that the brain is plastic, as Michelle said. Genes are not destiny. Every child can be helped to some degree by being taught the right things at the right time. And that's what these programs try to do. So one of the founders, Roger Weisberg, who was at Yale originally, we started this at Yale, moved to Illinois, University of Illinois, and for the state of Illinois, he and the group at Castle came up with some standards. This is now statewide. Everyone, every school, ages 5 to 8, is encouraged to teach children how to name emotions, how they lead you to act, how to control harmful impulses. This is a little hard at 5, but because of brain growth, it becomes easier by 8. And as Richie said, at age 5, you can predict how a child will do in life, and it's a stronger predictor than their self-regulation skills, than their IQ or the family they grow up in. But it's very important to understand that, this can be taught, that you don't have to just take how they are at 5. By age 8, you have a chance to teach them certain things. In the New Haven schools, they have a picture of a traffic light, red light, yellow light, green light. It says, when you're upset, remember the stoplight. Red light, stop, calm down, think before you act. Yellow light, think of a range of different things you could do. And green light, pick the best one and try it out. So children learn that from the beginning. This allows them to do what your friend Paul Ekman defines as maturity. He says maturity is widening the gap between your impulse and how you act. The longer you take, the better your decision can be. And this ability is called cognitive control in science. And it has to do with the prefrontal cortex and how it manages the emotional centers, particularly the amygdala. Would you agree, Richie? I always have to ask Richie if my science is right. So, and these circuits are very plastic, very shapeable by experience. So the more you get a child to put this in their daily repertoire, the stronger that circuitry becomes, in theory. This is plasticity. And there was a study done in New Zealand where they took children 5 to 8. They measured this ability in them. And they found that in the 30s, this was the best predictor of their health and their financial success, how well they could manage impulse. Very important, they found that children who were not good at it at age 5, but became good at it by age 8, did just as well as the children who at age 5 good. So what it shows is that social emotional learning can have a lasting impact beyond what our genes give us. And this is very hopeful sign. So, so at every age, there are different goals. At age 9 to 11, what are you feeling? What made you feel that way? How can you express a feeling in a way which is acceptable? Age 12 to 14, what causes you stress? But what motivates you? This is very important for kids because they get very stressed by school itself, by pressures, social pressures, so on. Ages 15 to 16, how your thoughts and feelings impact your decisions, how to cultivate a positive outlook, and then ages 17 to 18, your impacts on others of how you express your feelings, starting to look at the empathic dimension. And then they have the same set for empathy and social skills. I'm not going to go through each one, but I have to do this to get to the next slide. And then finally, responsible and ethical decision-making. So this, you have to understand, in the state of Illinois, which is very large, Chicago is the biggest city, every child is encouraged by the state standards to learn responsible, ethical decision-making. Explain when you're young why something is wrong to hurt others. 9 to 11, to respect the rights of others. 12 to 14, how honesty, fairness, and compassion mean you take others' needs into account in your decisions. So this is an ethical framework which is already in encouraged in these schools? Personal responsibility in ethical decisions? It's my ability to make a right or a wrong decision. And then finally, applying ethical reasoning in your own decisions. So this is something that schools are already encouraged to do. What you'll hear in coming days is how different programs, different SEL programs, are doing different aspects of this. I should also say that this is not a hard and fast sequence in a child's learning. You can teach each thing at a different age in a different way. Finally, there's a theory of social change. You articulated it just now earlier this morning, but I'd like to quote something that you said to some students in Vancouver, because it explains so very succinctly how what we're doing, the people in this room are doing, can affect society at large for the better. You said to these kids, this kind of education, education of the heart, can teach affection and a sense of responsibility. It's important for your own happiness and for your family's happiness. As families become more compassionate, society becomes more compassionate. And this is for the survival of humanity. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Yes. I'd like to turn to Your Holiness now to see if you have some questions, comments.
So maybe the fellow presenters or moderators might have questions.
When we say that 50% roughly for aggressivity is the genes and 50% the environment, that's of a passive exposure to the environment. With family. But now, if we actively and with the sense of direction and purpose, say, train our mind, that will add, or that will diminish the 50% of genetics through the expression of genes. So, in fact, it's not as engraved in stone as it might seem.
No, no, no. It depends. If you change...
Microphone.
Yeah.
You have a mic.
Yeah, but...
Can you...
No, it should be on.
They'll turn it on.
They'll turn it on.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to say is that if you change the environment...
Mike?
No.
Okay. If you change the environment, of course you will change the role of genes, because it's a different environment that you're creating. So genes are always relative to the environment when we assess their role. So it's never per se, it's always in relation to the environment. So,
but here it's inner environment. I mean, it's not like just we are actively...
Yes, exactly. Something. So you change the environment, you'll change the role of genes, likely.
I mean, there's another important point here, which is that if something is genetic, it says absolutely nothing about the ability of the environment to change it. Mm-hmm. So something can be 100% genetic. We know that there are certain disorders like PKU, it's a metabolic disorder, which can be completely changed by diet. So just because something is genetic says nothing about its ability to be transformed. Nothing.
Yeah, but the fact remains that those who carry those genes are more disposed towards that particular issue. Similarly, in the case of character.
Yeah. Yeah, it simply says it's just the issue of malleability.
The question I was going to ask Michelle is, the gene environment interplay, the complexity and all the rest, we can intervene, but is there a point at an age, say, for example, 20 or 25, whatever it is, beyond which there's not much you can do? I mean, is there a longitudinal study that says that if you miss the window of opportunity for intervention at this age, beyond that, it's your bad luck?
Well, the brain science would say, n'est-ce pas, that you still have new changes in the brain in very old people, right?
So yes, definitely.
So it's not over until it's over, so to speak. But there's, I think the main point that Richie made, and I think I was about to make in my presentation, is that a window of opportunity is early childhood. There's a lot that we can do to change things before they get consolidated by different developmental processes, crystallized in a way into the person. So early childhood we should think about early childhood as a...
However, I'd add to that... But isn't it also true that the emotional and social circuitry of the brain continues to develop and mature in the mid-20s, mm-hmm. which makes another window of opportunity during the school
adolescence.
Years?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's just going on in and out. Ms. Rollins was saying that when we understand how mind changes or effects on the mind, I'll just use this.
No, you're on your mic.
But it keeps going in and out.
So Ms. Rollins was saying that when we talk about the effects that can bring about a change, we can envision two types. One is a child being affected by the attitude and state of mind and the overall kind of atmosphere in the family. So in addition to having a gene, the environment in the family,
young age, more effective.
So young children may be much more susceptible to that kind of environmental change. But one can also think of another change process where the individuals themselves use critical reasoning, some kind of a reasoned thinking and critical thinking, and that then begins a kind of a process of change. And those one would expect the more older, the kind of grown up, would have a better ability to do that kind of effect, that kind of change.
Human brain, I think, fully developed, then the ability to analyze. So I think young age difficult. So that's more profound, more stable. I think young age, some kind of influence from other, without much conviction.
Right. And that really doesn't develop until the late 20s.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. Rob, you had... Rob, you have a question?
Take a minute.
Yes.
Yes, I wonder, Richie, if you want to, at a young age, because the child's mind is so plastic, we might think about how important it is to focus on the adults who are creating the environment for that child. And so these windows of opportunity, very young children, early teenage years, is also a time to think about the adults who are providing that training, that environment, that warmth for the child. So I think we'll hear a little about that as we go through the week.
And that's one of the elements of the best social-emotional learning programs. You involve the parents, you involve the teachers, you try to make the culture of the school warm and affectionate and supportive.
In Buddhist psychology or theory of education,
I think not necessarily Buddhist. I think Indian tradition.
Indian tradition.
Oh.
So in classical Indian tradition, there is this notion that when we talk about understanding, we gain new understanding. If you leave your understanding or the knowledge simply at the level of mere intellect, something that you have read somewhere, something that you heard somewhere, then its effect to change
so
is
young
very
age,
minimal.
Yuguru.
So,
for example, I usually describe my first teacher is my mother.
Oh, yeah.
About exactly. compassion.
Exactly.
Not something deeper level.
Yeah.
But simply, our mother never show angry face. Always smile, and give some sweet or something like that, some bread. My mother, expert making different variety of bread. Like that. There's something that Tujung Sujitati.
So to continue the translation, Isolis was saying that if your understanding or exposure is left only at the level of reading or just hearing about it, then its effect for bringing about change is quite limited.
Exactly.
But in order to bring about more change, you need to actually internalize that knowledge and process it through sustained thinking and applying it.
I think first then, level, even animal can learn. We show them smile
sure.
and give something they appreciate. Mm-hmm. So they themselves become more gentle, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yes.
But then the second level, analyze. That only
humans.
With human brain, no other animal.
So the what characterizes the second level of understanding is the sense of conviction that you have gained as a result of internalizing that knowledge and understanding. And then, of course, the most advanced level of understanding is when you've actually embodied it, what in Buddhist, in the Indian language, we will call understanding derived through meditative cultivation. So that is the highest form of knowledge.
I think, Sona, you had a question.
Is this working? Dan, I wanted to thank you for that summary of social-emotional learning and ask you a question about a reflection that I had in thinking about something that His Holiness shared at the beginning of this morning, which was the importance of a sense of oneness and shared humanity among all human beings
yes.
on this planet.
Yes.
And it seems to me in reviewing the elements that you showed that existing curricula teach in some sense the building blocks for that. But I wonder, are they going far enough? And do you see a gap there in terms of really teaching that?
So look at this. This is for empathy and social skills. These are the standards. Ages 17 to 18. That last one, have empathy, it actually means have empathy for people different than yourself, who seem to be different. Different religion, different ethnic group, whatever the difference may be that's relevant, different gender even. So I think that's another way of talking about the oneness of humanity, understanding we're all the same beneath the surface differences. Yeah.
I wanted to go back earlier to the comment about His Holiness, Your Holiness, that you made regarding, wouldn't it make sense for us to teach children who already have these capacities, or when they're older, when they have the capacities for analytical thinking, for critical thinking, because that may be when we can actually have them understand what to do to control their behavior in a more beneficial way. But I just wanted to connect what we were talking about with Michelle's talk back to that point, because it ends up that this thing called cognitive control, this ability to control our thinking and to even have constructive analytical thought is fully determined and influenced by the kinds of stresses that children can experience. So it may be that if we don't intervene early on, that their ability to have logical thought as they get older is compromised, which can set up the whole chain for their whole lives.
ine namju beju che de danda kyeongum jiga namana sing loya chalon chalon chesabe shugo modu namju khaburwa de ine danda de michel gi danda de tamche shugo na lo le ya kanda bu chunjung ga ba ya pame ge namjong go tone kengen chebe ye na ani stress and depression de de ga do che ani namju beju che ge ne ba khora ya chalon che modu de le 고겐 지금 메로스 디엔자다 칸다지 부글이야데 지기나 중중 가능 같네 되게 제가 최고였다 담당
나 부글이야 전부 최고야 되게 해 버셔
So in any case, the most important thing is to really show love to children. That really is the key.
I think the control, the very word control, I think you see, control physical can do by force. But control of mind cannot. Only, or say the, something like self, that's also kejong da, any kejong di yidi shebe taane, any semri yan juwa taaji. Di tang do nan dhaya ma to, chilo ne wanyu shen yan kyan ya ma.
So exercising control of the mind, unlike physical control, which can be done through fear and some other external force, but the exercising control at the level of mind ultimately really has to be voluntary. By the individuals themselves,
oh, yeah. Sure.
And which can only come if the individual sees the value of doing it by understanding why and what is the benefits of doing it.
However, the phrase cognitive control means the ability to move your attention here or there, to have positive thoughts or negative thoughts, and also to manage your emotions. That's the way in which it's used here. But your point is, of course, it's true.
Yes.
Cognitive control said the cognitive control subject so suzing tonyon gebe ka la tel tang zi cha dang dang san ti ju ko ma ro ya ta ani ya ji ni ba kar la te ma de ti ko wa de ton tang ni de pe ju ji ko re sa ji dang na kuran ju de na ko yu de na
ta ka na ta du lan ra ro jin zi ton
but in even here it's a voluntary we're talking about voluntary action.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes,
that's what a human being can do, not an animal.
So which is based on an understanding the value of doing it, which the, only the human
so,
beings
so the emotion, such as anger. What value? For your own peace of mind? No. Destroy. And your physical health? Again, this is some medical scientists. Yes. They say constant the anger, hatred, or very much eating our immune system.
It's true. Yes.
So your physical health also, you see, the anger, I think basically, I usually make distinction, constructive emotion, destructive emotion. What's the basis of construction? Destruction. Basically, we want happiness. So anything which brings happiness, that because of constructive. We do not want suffering. So any sort of action or emotion brings anxiety, fear, uncomfortable. That's a destructive. When we say, because of ethical, nothing to do with religion. Just our daily sort of happiness, joyfulness, and sorrow. Fear, demoralize. That's, we do not want that. So that is destructive. Any emotion brings more fear. It's destructive. And anger, one of them. Compassion brings inner peace, self-confidence. So we consider kasa chodhi, a constructive. So that we only human being, this brain, I think Richard, I think, know better. differences of animal brain. I think the kasachuti. Sensory level, I think animal brain, much some animal is much better than our.
Oh yes, very much so. No. Yeah. Pigeons have so much hearing, better eyesight than pigeons. Have much better eyesight than we
right,
have.
Right, that's right. And then I think elephant, their big nose. Excuse. So okay. They are, I think small, sort of the birds, I think their hearing, I think much stronger than us because their life much depend on these sensory feeling. But the part of the brain which analyze things. That's the human brain is much bigger, isn't it?
Yes.
So reasoning. I think education is actually meant for also increase ability of that part of the brain. Analyze. Now here, quantum physics, I feel quantum physics is very important. You see, our analyzing things, usually we based on appearances. Then mistake come. So we must go deeper way what's the reality. So now quantum physics, most of the destructive emotion very much based on appearances. There are often destructive emotion come, the object much sort of has the exaggerated negative side. Then much sort of attachment come, the again exaggerated the on the positive side, like that. Not the realistic. So therefore, now quantum physics very, very useful to know the reality. I think I mentioned briefly this morning, one Chinese quantum physicist. Many years, I have some sort of Kasota. Did this young man or us?
Sort of an expert, opinion now.
Oh, those quantum physicists, not only just understand the knowledge level, but fully convinced that there, you see, the act of emotion might be some differences. So some occasion, I express, I wish some sort of observation, those quantum physicists who sort of believe or who convinced there when some positive things, negative things happen, their emotional reaction might be differences. So last year, I heard one article wrote by one Chinese quantum physicist in mainland China. He mentioned those quantum physicists, you see, their attitude, you see, towards some positive or negative, they're more realistic. Not
too extreme. Not too extreme. Not black and white.
Exaggeration. So this, because you see, Kasa, Aaron Beck.
Larry, the cognitive behavior therapist. Psychologist.
Aaron Beck. You see, my first meeting with him, then his age already 84. In Sweden, one meeting. He told me he certainly not a religious-minded person, purely as a scientist, like that. So he told me when person, because of helping those people whose mind much disturbed because of anger. So he have a lot of experience. Now he told me the person who feel angry, much anger, then the object which that person feel angry anger, they appears very negative, but he mentioned 90% of that negativeness is mental projection. So now quantum physics, now you see nothing objectively exists, but much involve observer's own view.
Perception.
So therefore, you see, I felt maybe some differences. Now exactly the Chinese, you see, mentioned that. So therefore, we can say the most destructive emotion is no proper basis or kasa, valid foundation, valid kasa, base. So we cannot train that. We cannot increase the positive emotion. There's valid, the solid basis. Valid.
Basis now.
So we can train. We can reasoning further. Yes. So then thinking, analyze is that reality. Then our sort of enthusiasm, practice of compassion is can become much stronger than anger. Anger, if you analyze, today you feel very angry at some person. Next week, oh, that person may become a good friend. If this sort of appearances during anger appearance, because of the experience, that is something very negative, almost absolute. So if that is reality, then impossible to change next week. So all these just mental projection. Very clear. So one ancient Indian sort of was a philosopher or psychologist, loved guru, Chadan.
So this Indian master actually explained how extreme emotional reactions such as that manifest in the form of attachment and anger are really functions of certain projections of the mind, you know, attributes that we project, which them by themselves are also rooted in a certain conception of that reality.
So these things we call wisdom. Actually, fuller knowing, the reality. So that's, I think, a real sort of basis of our hope. Education provides more sort of the ability to analyze things. So then automatically, the negative emotion can reduce. Not talking about next life, not talking about the heaven or these things. Simply, as this morning, as I think today's world, a lot of problem is human creation. Basically, when these troublemakers, when they were young, 5 years old, simply they appreciate mother's affection. They themselves also very happy, play with other children. They never ask what's their family background, what their faith, what their nationality. They never ask. So sameness of human being at a very young age, very sort of alive. Then so-called education. Oh, you are Buddhist, you are Christian, you are Muslim. You are... Bronze destination or that nation. I think education sometimes, I think, creates a lot of more problems instead of solving. Okay, now I think time for lunch.
Yes. Thank you so much, Your Holiness, for this conversation, and we're looking forward to seeing you tomorrow morning to talk more about social and emotional learning and having an opportunity to learn from educators. So everyone take a break for lunch and then join us again afterward for the discussion and audience questions as well. Thank you.
Now, I want to say some scholars now.
At 1 o'clock.
No, it's not.
Some scholars.
What time is it?
You see, I think as far as they are, knowledge is concerned, their knowledge is much bigger than me. Because they spent many years study.
1:30.
But question is, sharpness of mind. Some cases, you see people spend 20, 30 years serious study.
So when they, even though they, some of them have studied for 20, 30 years, but when they apply their mind and analysis to a new topic, sometimes they get lost.
In that respect, I think because of my long time, my friend, our acquaintance, I think really immense help my brain more, Kasota,
open and fresh.
Oh. Like that.
Mine
Thank
too.
You.
Huh? Mine too.
Thank you. See you again tomorrow. So I hope to see further sort of discussion with our scholars. Thank you.